McDonald's Journalism Institute at the Missouri School of Journalism. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. We're going to talk today about a big moment in the country of Uzbekistan. Located in Central Asia between Afghanistan and Kazakhstan, the former Soviet Republic of 30 million is known for its spectacular mosques, its vast fields of cotton, and immense natural gas reserves. Uzbekistan is also a police state, and last month it announced President Islam Karimov had died. Karimov had been the only president the country has ever known and barred independent media while brutally suppressing dissent. In one instance in 2002, his government reportedly disposed of two political prisoners by boiling them to death. His presumed successor is Shavkat Mirziyayev, the country's prime minister who is now acting president. Mirziyayev takes over at a time when Russia, China, and the U.S. have all been competing for influence in the country, which has served as a transit hub to resupply U.S. forces in Afghanistan. Now, in a few minutes, we'll hear from a panel of experts who are going to unpack the human rights and international relations implications of Karimov's death. But first, we're going to learn a bit about life in the country from Navbahor Imamova. She's a journalist for the Voice of America's Uzbek Language Service, who is now studying at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Navbahor, welcome to Global Journalist.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, tell us just a little bit, if you would, about the trajectory of Uzbek history since the collapse of the Soviet Union over the past 25 years.
Wow, that is a long journey. I will be speaking as myself, as an Uzbek professional who has been covering the country from inside and from outside for a long time, and not on behalf of the Voice of America, I have to mention that. I was 13 years old when Uzbekistan became independent, and I remember at least a couple of years during that time when we felt like we were living in a relatively open and free society. Things were very different than they are now. But over the years, under the leadership of Islam Karimov, Uzbekistan turned into what I call classic dictatorship. Opposition was basically deleted. Any opposition voice was removed from the country, simply speaking. And the level of whatever freedom of media we had was also abolished over the years. But during the 90s, Uzbekistan had more international presence. They were more foreign organizations, let's say that freedom promoters, you know, present inside the country. But after what happened in 2005 in Andijan, you know, where a popular uprising was basically put down through security forces, and it ended in a very bloody way, things changed dramatically. And they went, let's just say that this was a time when President Karimov, who recently died, basically completely consolidated his power, and he became even more of a powerful guy in the eyes of the world. Uzbekistan, as you just mentioned, has a huge geopolitical importance. It is west of China, north of Afghanistan, somewhere south of Russia, and east of Iran. And the government of Uzbekistan has used that location in a very, very political way to basically claim leverage over the world, over the international community. And it's been a very difficult time for Uzbeks, for sure.
Well, we're going to pick up on a number. We're going to pick up on a number of these points that you raised, but I wanted to ask you about President Karimov's death, because there was some public uncertainty about exactly when he died. It seems like the government waited perhaps a few days before announcing his death. What can you tell us about that?
I believe President Karimov died sometime on August 29th, but it took them at least 3 days to announce that officially. A lot of people who have, let's just say that credible sources within the Uzbek government knew that he definitely died before September 2nd, when it was, announced officially. But I would be pretty confident to say that the majority of Uzbeks knew that he had already been dead when news came.
So why was there sort of this official silence? What's the purpose of that?
Well, I mean, the government needed time to prepare itself for something like this. Obviously, I mean, everybody knew that Karimov was going to die at some point, but not at this very moment, you know, at this very point. And I think Prime Minister Shavkat Mirziyoyev needed time to not only, you know, prepare for the funeral of the first president of Uzbekistan, which is obviously a huge event for in the history of the country, but also to, you know, to maneuver himself in a way that, you know, he has the power. He needed to gain the full control of the Uzbek government, and that required time.
Well,
it's a very complex political system, as you can imagine.
It sounds like it. And tell us, if you would, about the influence of the former Soviet Union on Uzbekistan. Now, this was a place, Uzbekistan, that was, like the rest of the Soviet Union, officially atheist and communist, and then the Soviet Union collapsed. So what replaced these ideologies?
Well, I mean, Uzbekistan was one of the, you know, former socialist, communist states of the USSR, but it wasn't that Islam had ever fully died in the country. You know, Uzbeks always considered themselves Muslims, at least nominal in many cases. So when the Soviet Union broke up, there was a sense of religious revival across the country. And we have to mention that the government itself promoted that. And if you look at the speeches of Islam Karimov from, you know, somewhere starting from 1990s all the way through 1993, 1994, he was a proud Muslim of Uzbekistan. He traveled across the Muslim world. He did promote this new identity of Muslim Uzbeks. He wanted to open up to, he wanted to connect with the rest of the Muslim world. And eventually he realized that that wasn't going to work for his advantage, because with that religious revival came a sense of very strong Muslim identity. You had many citizens who were now trying to mobilize, you know, to form political parties and also to have a standing as, like, you know, we're not only, they were, let's, they were challenging the status quo in ways that Karimov never imagined. And also there was some opposition, political opposition, with a very strong religious background. And that scared President Karimov a lot. And eventually he got rid of them. But those groups then turned into militant groups. And, you know, some of the remnants of which are still fighting in places like Pakistan. Now there are thousands of Uzbeks fighting in Syria, for example, in the ranks of ISIS, but also in other rebel groups. So those are the byproducts, I call, of that, you know, repression that Karimov started against the religious opposition.
And our time does grow short, but I wanted to ask you, you heard me in our introduction describe Uzbekistan as both a police state and a place that grows a lot of cotton, and the two are related in that I understand the government uses forced labor to harvest the cotton every year. What can you tell us about that?
Well, from what I know, this year it has gone on relatively better. So you don't have, let's say, forced child labor, or the government would completely deny the fact that even anyone is picking, you know, cotton by force. But a lot of people are mobilized this year, too. So if you don't, if you are called to pick cotton and if you don't want to, you pay. So this year, I was just talking to someone this morning, a university professor in Tashkent. They were collecting $200 from, you know, per person not to pick cotton. So they're subcontracting someone else to pick cotton that they're forced to. So this is how complex the issue is. But I have to mention something here, Jason. The Uzbekistan, you know, yes, there is no freedom of speech. There is no media freedom. It is still a police state. But Uzbeks, the Uzbek citizens, are more connected to the world than ever. You have more Uzbeks online. There are more cell phones in the country, I believe, than people themselves. You have millions of migrant workers in Russia and in other countries. So there is this connection that people feel to the world. And it would be too naive and you know, too stupid in ways to say that, oh, you know, Uzbeks don't know what's happening outside of Uzbekistan, or they're not connected. So they are connected. They know. They don't have the experience, and they don't have the confidence to challenge the status quo.
Nav Bahori Mamova, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
A reminder that you're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Today we're talking about the Central Asian nation of Uzbekistan, which finds itself at a crossroads after the death of its first and only president. To continue our discussion, we're going to bring in three other people who follow Uzbekistan closely. Joining us now from Washington, D.C. is Mohammed Tahir. He's the host of a podcast about Central Asia called Majlis, put out by Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. In Los Angeles, we're joined by Steve Swerdlow, a Central Asia researcher for Human Rights Watch. And in St. Louis, Missouri, is Sarah Kendzior, a freelance journalist who has written about Uzbekistan for outlets including Foreign Policy, Al Jazeera, and The Atlantic. Welcome to all of you. Sarah Kendzior, let me start with you. You've written extensively about this cult of personality around the former president, Islam Karimov. What can you tell us about that?
You know, his cult of personality tends to sometimes be played down only because the neighboring states which had such elaborate ones. For example, in Turkmenistan, their former president, you know, had a giant statue of himself made of gold that rotated to face the sun. And so when you have things like that, it seems like Karimov, who was more of a bureaucratic figure, was mild. But, you know, Karimov had this cult of personality that became very evident, most evident to me, after he died. You know, excerpts from his speeches in which he, you know, had talked about threats to Uzbekistan, both internal and external, and how the state could be the only one who could prevent them, were widely circulated. He presented himself as the father of Uzbeks, as, you know, some were calling him the grandfather of Uzbeks because the population of Uzbekistan is relatively young. You know, people related to him in a very personal way. That doesn't mean it's universal. You know, there are, as Navbahor said, you know, there are differing views. People aren't allowed to necessarily express them. But, you know, he was the only founder, the only president of Uzbekistan, the only leader that most people living there ever knew. And so that inevitably is going to, you know, create a rather intense personal association, whether you like him or not.
And Steve Swerdlow, we heard Navbahor Imamova talking about this massacre in this town called Andijan that happened in 2005, where hundreds of people were killed, hundreds of unarmed people, we should say, were killed during an anti-government protest. What sort of the legacy of that massacre? How did that sort of change the trajectory of Uzbek politics?
Yeah, Navbahor is absolutely right. This is a seminal moment in Uzbekistan's development when, in a way, Uzbekistan's already completely abysmal human rights record, which included, you know, widespread torture, thousands of political prisoners, on that day, on May 13, 2005, really went off a cliff because Karimov personally gave the order to his troops to surround a square filled with thousands of protesters, mainly peaceful, although there were some armed elements in the crowd who were protesting about the terrible socioeconomic conditions, the corruption in Uzbekistan, a lot of the problems that plagued the society. And rather than come and address the crowd, as many people that day expected, he would come, he would talk to them, he would address the crowd, he actually gave the order to shoot to kill. Opening fire without warning on hundreds of peaceful civilians, killing women and children and others. And it was a massacre. It was Eurasia's worst massacre since the collapse of the former Soviet Union. And rather than allow an independent investigation after those events, Karimov clamped down. He kicked out all human rights organizations, all media organizations. And since 2005, the New York Times hasn't been able to send even a single reporter in, the BBC. My organization was able to sort of hang on by a thread for several years after the massacre in Tashkent. I was there in 2010, but we were also kicked out eventually. So it really set Uzbekistan on a destructive path to, you know, an even worse human rights record. And it's something that, you know, the legacy of Andijan still, I think, in many ways defines its relationship with the world. And if it's not addressed, if there won't be accountability for that, I don't think we can expect accountability for a lot of the other abuses and other problems in Uzbekistan.
And Mohammed Tahir, we heard Steve just talking about sort of this brutal repression that's taken place in the country. How would you compare Islam Karimov, the deceased president, with his presumed successor, Shavkat Mirziyoyev? What are some of the differences between them?
I think there is no much of difference because he is taking over the legacy of Karimov, and he was the guy with Karimov all the time from years and years as a governor of Jizak before, and then district mayor, then the prime minister. So he is just a body. And when I look at him, Shavkat Mirziyoyev, I see the Turkmenistan's current president in his shoes, like the way he took over the power in violation of the constitution. And then, the way...
Sorry, this is because the Constitution says that the president of the Senate was supposed to take power if the president dies, and in fact the prime minister sort of just walked in and became acting president. Is that right?
Exactly. And the same thing happened in Turkmenistan when the Turkmen president died in 2006, which is the neighbor of Uzbekistan. The constitution say that the Senate of the chairman of the parliament is supposed to be the successor. But again, in the same day, there was, you know, they found a reason to arrest the chairman of the parliament and Berdimuhamed, of the current president of Turkmenistan, become the president. And when he was the president at the beginning, he took some sort of decisions which gave us and some other journalists following Turkmenistan and Central Asia, an impression that maybe he's easing up. And the same thing Shavkat Mirziyoyev is doing in Uzbekistan. Like what Berdimuhamedov did was like reversed some of the very, very strange decision that his successor took, like changing names of the, you know, months and years after his family members and all these things. What Shavkat Mirziyoyev is doing, like recently he did one thing which is called virtual reception, I believe, where people can send complaints, and then the idea behind that is that the complaint will be followed up and that the problem will be solved. And I was just listening today our Uzbek broadcast at Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and the women from Tashkent sent a complaint to that reception, and that complaint was sent back to the managers of the area where this citizen is based. And now this female is called in public, shamed at how she dares to complain the regional leaders to the president. So I just see no difference between Karimov and Shavkat Mirziyoyev. And I just see what has happened since the death of the Turkmen president in 2006. The same thing is repeating in Uzbekistan these days.
Well, Sarah Kenzie, we heard Mohammad Tahir talking about how it appears there's going to be this continuation of a fairly stringent police state here. Talk to us about U.S. relations with Uzbekistan, given the country's fairly miserable human rights record. What are some of the defining features of that?
I mean, we don't have much in the way of a relationship with Uzbekistan right now. We were drawn into a closer relationship with Uzbekistan following the war in Afghanistan because of military connections. But after Andijan, you know, there was worldwide international condemnation of that incident, a call for a UN investigation, among other things. And, you know, as Steve noted, Uzbekistan became somewhat of like a pariah state, and that included to a degree its relationship with the United States. They got very angry with us. You know, they kicked us out of there. Since then, you know, the government has had to collaborate with them at numerous times. There's different people within the United States government who have different views on Uzbekistan. You know, some have been quite vocal about the human rights situation. Others have completely abided it and you know, allowed it to pass without much critique. I don't really think we're the ones who are going to have much of an influence in Uzbekistan, you know, in the years, in the months and years to come. I think you should really look more at Russia and at China and at other, you know, closer states that have trade and, you know, political ties to Uzbekistan than look at, you know, the role the United States is going to be playing, because I think it's going to be fairly minimal.
A reminder that you're listening to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Today we're talking about the Central Asian nation of Uzbekistan, which is at a turning point after the death of its first and only president, Islam Karimov. If you're interested in more about this and other undercovered international issues, visit us online at globaljournalist.org. There you can find an archive of our past shows and our coverage of foreign affairs and human rights. You can connect with us on YouTube and Facebook, or follow us on Twitter at GlobalJourn. Steve Swerdlow, I wanted to come back to you to talk about this issue of forced labor in the cotton harvest. We heard Navbahor Imamova speaking about this, talking about how people can pay to get out of going through this sort of conscription process to work in the fields there. How does that work? How has it worked in the past?
Well, you know, it's a massive Soviet command economy, but it's almost a war effort, the way people are mobilized. Nabokov was absolutely right when she said that children used to be mobilized on a massive scale across the country, but I wouldn't characterize it as an improvement. You know, there was a worldwide boycott by apparel brands such as The Gap, Walmart, Gymboree. Over 200 apparel companies came out and said they would not knowingly use Uzbek cotton in their supply chain. as long as this practice of modern slavery in Uzbekistan continues. And so I think because of that pressure, because of this international boycott, because of a few steps taken by courageous diplomats, putting sanctions on Uzbekistan, we did see some improvements for the better. But by and large, we're talking about more than a million people right now out in the fields in Uzbekistan who, on pain of punishment, are goaded, are forced by neighborhood committees, by school directors, by mayors, by police officers, by the governors, up into the president. It's a very highly centralized system to go pick the cotton, meet their daily quotas. And, you know, that is the white gold, it's called, of Uzbekistan's economy. It's, you know, it's drilled into the population. This is an obligation of every person to make this contribution to the state. And then that cotton is sold on the international market at an enormous profit. Also, of course, farmers who, you know, don't have a choice about what they can grow. They can't grow potatoes. They have to grow cotton. So it drives a lot of farmers into bankruptcy. We've seen a lot of suicides as well. Mm-hmm.
And Mohammed Tahir, if I could turn this discussion to the issue of press freedoms in Uzbekistan. I understand that actually the world's longest imprisoned journalist is in Uzbekistan, a guy named Mohammed Bekjanov, who was arrested way back in 1999. So he's been in jail for something like 17 years. Tell us about his case.
Yeah, Mohammed Bekjanov is obviously one of the longest serving journalists in jail, and Steve's organization, Human Rights Watch, just had a long press statement about him. And he is one of the cases. And there are a number of other press freedom-related issues in Uzbekistan, the brightest example of which might be our own operation. Soon after the Andijan event, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's bureau was shut down in Uzbekistan. Since then, our journalists are not able to get the accreditation that they need to work in Uzbekistan. And on the top of that, just recently, brother of one of our Uzbekistan service staffer, who is based in, he himself is based in Prague, but his brother in Uzbekistan being put in jail, and he was given 8 years just because his brother is working for Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty. And I hear few other our Uzbekistan service staffers in Prague, his relatives in Uzbekistan are banned leaving the country, and still they have the exit visa system in place. So it is, Uzbekistan is, you know, no surprise when you see Uzbekistan year after year in the bottom of the Freedom House's report on press freedom. So it is a hell for journalists to be based in Uzbekistan. It's a difficult, difficult job there.
And Sarah Kenzier, there is this kind of interesting figure in Uzbekistan, the daughter of the former president, Islam Karimov. Her name's Gulnara Karimov. For a while, it seemed like she was going to be the successor of her father. And then at some point, her father has her placed under house arrest. This is after she'd been ambassador to the United Nations, held a number of sort of top positions in government. Can you just tell us a bit about her?
Yeah, I don't think she was ever really a plausible contender for president of Uzbekistan. You know, Gulnara does have some formal accreditations, you know, her ambassadorship, her alleged, you know, her Harvard degree for which she allegedly worked, but is best known for, you know, later in life trying to be a pop star under the name of Gugusha. She also was, you know, a jewelry and fashion designer and just kind of a socialite. She became noted more, though, since around 2012 for two things. One was being at the center of a giant international finance corruption scandal, especially as telecommunication companies worldwide, in which, you know, it was proven that she, you know, it's very complicated, but basically had embezzled a large amount of money and made a lot of illegal financial transactions that cost the government of Uzbekistan a great deal. As she was doing this, she became a prominent social media figure. She's very active on Twitter. She would feud with a lot of, you know, Western Western critics, in particular of Uzbekistan, you know, including me, you know, at one point she said that the security services was going to come and kill me. The reason for that is she was upset that I had insulted her Swiss villa. So this is sort of the level of reality that, that Gulnara existed in at the time. She was put under house arrest by her own father's administration following the revelations of these telecommunications scandals. And I think this is for two reasons. You know, one was they didn't want her to talk. She was very chatty. She didn't know when to shut up on social media. And two, it was, you know, a form of punishment and containment to make sure that they didn't, you know, lose any more money than they did, and, you know, and to keep her from dealing with law enforcement. It's unclear what will happen to her now. There's someone on Twitter who appears to be pretending to be her. I do not think it is actually her. She was not present at the funeral, although her sister Lola was. You know, from what I understand, she's remaining under house arrest in Tashkent. You know, and I guess we'll see whether Mirziyoyev releases her. I'm kind of doubtful because I think at heart this is a financial problem for them. And, you know, the Uzbek state likes to consolidate money in that way and make sure they're able to keep as much as they can. And Gulnara is a risk in that aspect.
And I should say that we did reach out to the Uzbek government, to the Uzbek embassy in the United States, to try to get them to send someone onto this program to give their version of events inside Uzbekistan. But I want to turn this back to you, Steve Swerdlow. This is a moment now when there is a presidential transition going on in the country. There is going to be an election in December, although the outcome doesn't seem to be in doubt. What sort of leverage do Western countries, do outside organizations have to try to argue for progress on human rights, on democracy, on some of these issues like torture of prisoners inside Uzbekistan?
Right. No, I mean, you know, and Jason, I want to go back for a second. This question connects to the earlier one you asked about the U.S. role. I disagree a bit with Sarah in that I think the U.S. does have a substantial relationship, one that, as she said, mainly military. Our government, the U.S. government, is providing military assistance. About a year ago, in fact, Novel reported on this development. There were 300 MRAPs, mine-resistance armored personnel carrier vehicles, delivered to Uzbekistan. This is a country that, as we discussed, you know, engaged in a large-scale massacre against its own people. And so Washington has absolutely, you know, a very important role to play right now in this pre-election period. I think the United States, the European Union, and other actors such as the World Bank, the IMF, they need to be very clear about what they want to see from the sure-to-be next president, Mirziyoyev. So, I mean, I think those demands should include not just holding free and fair elections, but perhaps more importantly, we should be articulating our demands that they release political prisoners, of which there are 10,000. I mean, stop for a second and think that how does that compare to the rest of, you know, Russia, Belarus, Azerbaijan? You put all the repressive countries of the former Soviet Union together, and you don't even get close to 10,000 political prisoners in Uzbekistan. So I think if the international community presses hard, I'm not saying that we'll see major developments and changes, but the lesson from my work is that pressure does work. I think the Cotton Campaign has done enormous things to stop child labor. I think the same can be done to end torture and release political prisoners.
That's going to have to do it for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Missouri School of Journalism and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. Many thanks to Navbahor Imamova, Mohammed Tahir, and Steve Swerdlow, as well as Sarah Kenzier. Our assistant producers this week are Domenico Zapponi, Rachel Foster-Gimbel, and Renee Hickman. Our visuals editor is Anadil Iftikhar, and our lead producer is Vera Tan. Travis McMillan is our director. Pat Akers of KBIA is Global Journalist audio engineer. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for tuning in.